Okay, so we'll get started. Last time we were looking at radio transmission systems in general, so these are trying to communicate bits or sequences of bits, again over a distance, and we saw that there were various components. And the last one we looked at was the modulation technique, which we said would take the form of some sort of sinusoid, so a carrier frequency signal at which we modified in some way. Okay. And depending on how we modified it, then we'd get different performance out of the system, where performance could be what the loss rate is, or in this case, a bit error rate. What bit rate could you squeeze out of the channel? Okay, so where, which would be again encapsulated in this idea of bandwidth efficiency. So, given a certain bandwidth in the channel, how many bits, at what rate can you push bits through? Okay, and so. Obviously, the error that you get is going to be dependent on the noise in the system and the power you're willing to put into your signal. But it's also going to then be related to, again, how many bits you're trying to push through and how many bits you're able to push through. So in this first problem, we're going to sort of explore those relationships. So we're going to fix our bit error rate, because that's typically what you do, is you say, well, I don't want any more than a certain number of, or a certain percentage of your bits lost. And so then we'll also fix the signal-to-noise ratio, and we'll examine for each of these different modulation techniques what sort of bandwidth efficiency we'll then need in order to achieve our bit error rate. Okay. So the bit error rate is going to be dependent on our modulation technique, and also what bandwidth efficiencies are achievable is dependent on our modulation technique. So, in the notes, we should have results saying that the EV over N0, so the energy per bit over noise density, is related to the signal-to-noise ratio, and then, again, the bandwidth efficiency. The more efficient your system, smaller EV and N0 you can achieve. Okay. Our EB over N0 then is related to BER. I thought I moved the slide. Okay. And then that's going to depend on what modulation technique you're using. So we want this BER 10 to minus 7, so we're all the way at the bottom here. And depending on what technique you use, you get a little over 11 up to 14, over 14 dB needed. Okay. So going back, we can then relate that to our required bandwidth efficiency, And so, again, depending on what modulation scheme you're using, you have a required dB around zero in SNL, and then comparing that to the signal to noise ratio, we get what our required the unknown then is our bandwidth efficiency. Hold on to that. And so for FSKMS, we get 0.6. PSK, we get 1.2. QPSK, again, we're trying to squeeze more bits into a signaling element, so our bandwidth efficiency is doubled for that. Okay, the question then becomes, are these bandwidth efficiencies achievable? And again, what is achievable is dependent on what scheme we're using and how well we're implementing that technique. And so if we just look at the ask in FSK, again, for both we need 0.6. And we see that, we can actually do that for us, but not FSK. Okay. So, if we wanted to do things this way, we actually would not necessarily be able to achieve what we wanted. So we'd have to either accept a higher bit error rate, or possibly we could improve the relation by increasing the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay. And so we can look at a similar idea, but now explore how changing the level of a system changes the equation. So again, we're now trying to squeeze more bits into a single signaling element. Now fix our EB over N0, and we ask the question, well, what sort of bit error rates can we achieve, and what bandwidth efficiencies can we achieve? And again, now we can ask what sort of signal-to-noise ratio that produces. Okay. So, again, our relation between the damage of noise and EBR depends on the level of the encodings, how many bits that you're trying to squeeze into a signal, and therefore how many elements do you have to change in the signal. And similarly, our efficiency is going to be dependent on how many levels we have with more levels leading to a lower efficiency. Okay, so bandwidth efficiency, again, is depending on exactly how you implement your modulation. So we're going to assume our factor zero here, and we get a comparison of BR versus our bandwidth. efficiency. And so what we observe is that our bit error rate is reducing, so that's good. But our bandwidth efficiency now is decreasing as well, so which is essentially meaning you're squeezing less bits into your spectrum, okay, so you have a broader spectrum. And I'll leave you to work out then what happens with your signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, so again, there's, just keep at the back of your mind, but there is this interplay between, again, how much energy you're willing to put in the signal, what sort of error rate you're willing to tolerate, and how efficiently you want to use your spectrum. Okay. So this time we're going to concentrate on the radio link, the radio channel aspect of our digital comms system, and again, see what the properties of a radio channel are, relative to the relatively well-behaved wired channels. Okay. So the bulk of this lecture is drawn from William Stallings, his chapter 5. Again, other texts will go into all this stuff in more detail. He gives a very sort of nice summary, which is what we're going to stick with, is primarily a nice summary of what the effects are. Okay, so that we understand how these channel effects are influencing the design of our systems. Okay. So we're going to look at the three main topics. First, we're just radio signals are transmitted by antennas, so we're going to have a quick look at, what your options are in antennas and what are the relevant properties that we care about. We're then going to examine for the rest of the lecture what happens to the signal as it travels over a distance, and what happens to any signal as it travels over a distance? It degrades, okay, and you can pretty much categorize how radio signals degrade into two components. First, sort of over large distances, they're declining. They're declining at a rate of at least the distance squared. Okay. And so we'll look at what happens in an ideal case. So you have free space loss and then squared, and then observe that we don't actually have an ideal case, and see if, again, just sort of on a large scale, how this impacts on their signals and the signal strength. And so again, you could think that this isn't too far off from one another. Again, a wired signal, it's going to decline, although again, it's less predictable. Unfortunately, mobility again, the fact that the signal can travel over different paths introduces effects where changing distance by very small amounts can significantly alter the strength of the signal. Okay. And can do it in some fairly inconvenient ways. Okay. And so that's something that's fairly distinct for radio systems. Okay. So an antenna is an electrical conductor, a system of conductors used for transmission, so sending a radio frequency into the air, into the environment, and reception, receiving that energy and collecting it back into a radio, of the radio frequency signal. So the same antenna is used for both transmission and reception, and typically the characteristics of the antenna are the same for transmission and reception. No, typically they won't be the same. Your access point will have a different type of antenna than, well, your mobile, for instance. So no, they don't have to have the same characteristics. So one of the main characteristics that we care about for antennas is the radiation pattern. And so how does the signal radiate from the antenna? Okay. And it can either radiate sort of in every direction, or it can be directional and sort of concentrate the energy of the signal into a specific direction. Okay. And again, the reception pattern of an antenna is the same as the transmission pattern. So if it's concentrating the energy in a certain direction, it's going to be receiving signals from that direction and unable to receive signals from other directions. Okay. So there's loads of different types of antennas. These are some of the most common, and they can get very fancy as combinations of these, etc. So an isotropic antenna doesn't exist in reality, but it's an idealization of an antenna which is radiating in all directions equally. Okay, so it's a handy concept because then you can compare directionality relative to this isotropic antenna. Dipole antennas can be used to produce equal radiation in the first instance in a two-dimensional plane, so along a plane, and then depending on how they're constructed, you can get something approximating an isotropic antenna. Okay. You can also, somewhat, and you can also produce directionality with dipole antennas. The sort of conceptually easiest way to have a parabolic, to have a directional antenna is to have a parabolic antenna, so a dish, and so wherever the dish is pointing, that's the way the signals are being transmitted and collected. Okay. And so you have the sort of micro antennas of the telecoms. So again, talking about a cellular system, at the base station, you have omnidirectional antennas, so sending and receiving signals in all directions, in a plane anyway, sending them into sectors, so again, you think of dividing the plane up into regions, or even point to points. For communication with fixed points. The phone antennas then are going to want to try and radiate in all directions. Okay. So again, dipole antennas can be used to approximate isotropic antennas, at least in a flat region, and they radiate in a direction relative to the direction the antenna is pointing. And because they're not radiating up and down, you get the gain from what you would from an ideal isotropic antenna. Okay, and again, if you're not going to normalize relative to an isotropic, you can if you have a directional antenna, you can normalize relative to what you would get from a dipole. Okay, so again, your basic pattern is it's going to produce a donut. And as you play around with frequency, then you can get something that more approximates a sphere. So dipoles, again, can be used for radiating in all directions. Parabolic antennas are used for focusing your signal in a fixed direction, and so you have a focus and then you have the panel. And so as the signal radiates, the shape of the parabolic shape works to reflect all the signals into a single direction. And so that focuses your signals into a single direction. Okay. So the main takeaway we need from that is the idea of gain as a measure of the directionality of an antenna. And so gain is the increase in power in a particular direction compared to to an omnidirectional antenna. And gain is related to what's called effective area, which is a function of the size and shape of the antenna. So the size and shape are going to govern, you know, how concentrated the signal is. Okay. So one point to note is that gain is related to the relationship between error and gain is also related to the frequency of your carrier signal. Okay. So you're going to achieve for the same, you know, area is essentially going to be fixed. So for a fixed effective area, you're going to achieve different gains depending on what frequency of the signal is. Okay, so we're sending this signal out now, and what happens to it? Well, it's obviously traveling, and there's three modes in which these sorts of signals can travel. There are ground waves, and these follow the contour of the Earth. And they are restricted to low frequency signals. They're not going to be too much interest to us. They're not used in the bands that we're interested in. Their main advantage is that because they're following the contour of the Earth, they can travel for long distances. Okay. The second option is you can have a sky wave, which is bouncing between the Earth's surface and the outer atmosphere. And so again, these can produce very large ranges, but do not operate again in the frequencies that we're interested in. The mode that we are interested in is what's called line of sight. And this operates in these higher frequency ranges. And at, you know, a first cut, that means that you have to have a path between sender and receiver with no obstructions. So in reality, we're not going to get that too often. We're going to have various factors that are going to change this. The atmosphere itself changes the path. If you have objects in the way or nearby, then the signal starts bouncing off these objects. So, we're going to look at sort of how the signal changes and how these factors impact on the change of the signal. Okay, so this slide, you know, slight out of order here. I said that the line of sight was a direct point-to-point connection. And typically what you think of is a horizon, so the curve of the Earth is actually going to as it happens, then it's just something to note, the signal will actually bend around the curve of the Earth, again due to refraction, and this will give you a slightly greater line of sight. So how do you use this factor to calculate what the maximum distance between any two points is? Again, that's assuming that you know you have clear space between you and the second point. If you do have clear space, well, what's happening? Your signal is still declining. Signals always decline, and for radio signals, there's space loss. In reality, you have other factors which are interfering with the signal. So even just sending through an atmosphere, there's just free space is causing absorption and diffusion of the signal. If you don't have a clear path between the two signals, the two sender and receiver, then your signal's typically bouncing off all of these things, so you end up getting multiple copies of your signal arriving at the receiver. And finally, if you're moving, all of that gets you, all of that is changing as you move. So, we categorize these changes as being either large scale or small scale, where fading refers to, again, this decrease in the power of the signal with distance. Okay. So, the first, in fact, we're going to look at is large-scale fading, and this is what happens, again, over large distances. So, if I'm here making a phone call and the base station is a mile away, then, what's the decline? Small-scale fading are these effects that happen with small changes in distance between me and this receiver that's a mile away. Okay. And these small-scale changes happen when I'm in motion. And due to the motion itself, and also due to how that motion is changing the multipath characteristics. So moving, I'm changing exactly how the signal bounces off whatever various things there are in my way. Okay. So two possible things can happen. You get attenuation, so just the signal, the amplitude of the signal is decreasing, but it's doing this in a uniform way. And so that's fairly easy to deal with. You also get distortion, so some frequency components are going to be affected more than others, and this is more complex to deal with. Okay, so we're going to start by looking at our large-scale fading. So, again, let's assume that I'm standing still and I'm at a fair distance from the base station. Okay. And in this case, we can characterize the power loss in the first instance by what's called free space loss. And here the ratio of the transmitted power to the received power is a function of the distance between the antennas and the wavelength, or conversely, the frequency at which the signal is being sent. And so what this means is that our power, our received power, is dropping with d squared, with the square of the distance from me from sender to receiver. Okay, and so that happens even if you're out in space. So, again, you can characterize the loss, so this drop in decibels, as well as just as a ratio. And we see that the loss increases with the frequency, increases with the distance. Okay. But typically, since we will fix the frequency and be more concerned with this drop in distance. We can improve matters by introducing a directional antenna, and then gain comes into play. So gain will slow lower that ratio. Okay. But it's still going to drop with d squared. Okay. Again, we can look at that in terms of loss and see that, again, gain is a factor that's decreasing our loss. So frequently what we do is we normalize our power relative to standard distance, power measured as standard distance, where that distance is different depending on whether you're indoors or outdoors. But we can see from that again this power is dropping according to d squared. Okay, so no matter what you do, that drop occurs. If you're in any terrestrial landscape, aside from maybe the Nevada salt flats or something, your signal is going to encounter obstacles. And it's going to change based on those obstacles. Okay. So here we can think of a signal radiating out from our sender. And it's going to bounce. So if there's a flat surface, the signal will bounce off that surface and go in and take a different path to the base station. The signal will bend around sharp edges, and so again, that'll take the different path to the base station. And it could possibly travel through sort of diffuse objects and will sort of spread and scatter. The upshot of this is that instead of having a single signal arrive at the base station, you're going to have multiple related signals arriving at the base station. Okay. It's possible that you will have no direct line of sight path from sender to receiver. And yet, because of all of these, this bouncing and bending, you will still receive the signal. So it's both a plus and a minus. Okay. The problem with having all these multiple paths from sender to receiver is that they're all traveling slightly different distances. And so what we'll see is that if you have a sinusoidal signal, that's going to translate into all of them being received with slight phase differences. Okay. And what those slight phase differences are going to mean is that the amplitude will either combine or to increase, or it will sort of decrease if a significant, sufficient dynamic phase. Okay. So what that means is that it's no longer that easy to predict the power at which your signal is arriving. Okay. So the concept of a signal coming from different along different paths is referred to as a multipath effect, and again it leads to either reinforcement or cancellation of the original signal. Okay. So, in addition to that, we can get an effect called time dispersion. And what happens here is if you have, say, a direct signal and one which is reflecting off a distant object, then there's a significant difference in the length of the paths. And so, one signal is going to be significantly delayed from another. Now, if you think of that signal as being a train of bits being sent, what this means is that, again, along your short path, you receive a bit. At the same time, along your longer path, you're going to get a previous bit being received. Okay. And so this causes inter-symbol interference. Which can make it difficult for the receiver to determine which is the correct symbol. Okay. So again here we have a direct path, and then we're also going to bounce off a mountain. So we send one, and then we send a zero. So those are in train. By the time the zero is reaching a car, the reflected one is also reaching a car. So it's interference. What you hope again is that because of the distance, this will be of lesser power, but yeah, depending on other effects, that may or may not be the case. So, just to get a slight mathematical feel for what's going on, we're going to look at a two-path propagation loss. So here, we're trying to send a signal to our car, and we have a line of sight path, but we also can bounce off the ground. So we're going to examine how just having those two paths will affect the power at which our signal is received. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to normalize our signal relative to, again, the zero, so the power measure at a fixed point. And then observe that what's going to change is the phase of the signal, and also the amplitude as it travels over a certain distance path. So we have a sinusoidal signal, but we can look at it in the complex domain as being the real part of a complex signal. And we have it just changing two bar frequency, t minus then tau, which is the accounts for this. So our change in power then is the change as well as the change in distance and phase. So that encapsulates what's changing about the two signals. Okay. So the first thing we want to do is to look at our distances, b1 and b2, so the distances from the two paths. Okay, and so our B is the distance between sender and receiver, then our direct line of sight path is going to give us H1 minus H2 squared plus B squared, and then square root of that is your distance. And if you sort of think of flipping this portion down, you'll see that your second distance is H1 plus H2 squared plus B squared, and then the square root of that. Okay, so that's just that is. Now, typically, again, if you're any distance away from each other, then we can say, well, D is a lot bigger therefore both signals are traveling roughly distance, approximately distance. Okay. What that says then is that the change in power is going to be affected by the phase change. So the phase change can be related to the change in distance. And we can work out the change in distance by doing a Taylor expansion. So, plugging in our change in distance to a phase change, we get that B is a function of H1H2 over B. And we further observe that if delta t is small, which again is H1, H2 are much smaller than b is going to be, then we can approximate e to delta t by 1 minus j b, which gives us then our power draw as a function of delta t squared. So from there, all we have to do is plug in, and the bottom line becomes that our power is now dropping as d to the fourth. We have free space loss of d squared, now we get d to the fourth. Okay. So that's two paths, and in general, in any sort of crowded environment, as we saw in the original picture, you're going to have thousands of paths. You're going to have quite a few paths. Okay. So this makes it fairly difficult to calculate path loss analytically, and typically this would only be done for fairly fixed environments. Okay. It is important to have at least some handle on the loss, and so typically one approach has been to develop models which are based on empirical data. So you go and you take lots of measurements. You do some sort of curve fitting based on those measurements. And you use that then to try and predict how loss will occur in similar environments. Okay. So typically, again, the data would be some urban environments, and those being the most subject to these multipath effects. Okay. So one of the first and simplest is the Lee model, and that would be based on measurements taken in Los Angeles. A more complex model is the Akimura model, and this is based on Tokyo data. And then the Hata model is the Akimura model uses some curves over which you have to parameterize curves, so you have to read the data off. The Hata model tries all to numerical values. And so the approach would be to, so these models would fit the city, which was used quite well, and then you try and infer something about other cities from those. Okay. So, you know, an observation is, for instance, Akimura, it's based on Tokyo, which, you know, like Dublin, it's a fairly flat city. Okay, so quite a few buildings, but they're not that tall necessarily. Okay, so it wouldn't be likely to be that useful, for instance, in downtown Manhattan. Okay. So, the approach is to take a lot of measurements and try and parameterize the loss factors and then curve fit, so pick values for those parameters based on the observed value. Okay. So, for the Lee model, what are loss factors? Well, we have our distance, and that's going to be decreasing some gamma, so two or more. The frequency is also going to be significant. And then we have a sort of a touch. So we have our reference power, gamma is going to be based on measurements. So again, we start with one city, and maybe we can take measurements of other cities as well. And then we have, again, correction factors, which take into account essentially the characteristics of the antennas. Okay. Okay. So, again, the initial measurements would have been taken with sort of a fixed setting, and we try and expand from there. The Akimura model is going to take a similar approach. It is more complex and uses more precise measurements. Okay. So, for Akimura, the heights and frequencies change, and the measurements were curve fitted for the various heights and frequencies. What you end up with is something similar. You have some function of frequency and distance. So again, let's, you know, what factor are we dropping by with distance? And then gains for antenna heights. The type of terrain you're in. Okay. So, again, both our gains and our attenuation are going to be functions of the frequency distance, and then the correction factor will vary with frequency, distance, and with the type of frequency and the type of terrain. Okay. The height gains are just numerical. They're functions. Okay, and that's just what those height gains would look like. Okay. So, again, you can take all of those factors and then fix distance, heights, frequencies, and try and approximate your loss based on that. Okay. So again, we can calculate our free space loss. We go to the curves to calculate our attenuation. The type of terrain. Okay. So we get approximately 34 for the attenuation and about 9 for the distance. This one? Oh, because this is the distances. And this is the attenuation, so it's just the way the graph is set up. Okay, so your attenuation of a function frequency and distance. Okay, and so your frequencies are here, and your distances are here, so you have to then find the curve following the distance to intersect the frequency that you want. Okay, and again, these gain factors are a function, they're arrived at by plugging into functions. So, I have a tutorial problem where you guys work through that. I've never asked it on an exam, but it is sort of, you can appreciate what you need to do to do these sorts of use these sorts of models. Okay. And one of the things we were doing, as we saw, which we were reading off of plots, so for attenuation and gain. And so just what can be done to make life easier? Well, the Pappa model tries to turn those plots into functions. Okay. And again, you're going to have to have a different formula then for each of the different terrains. Okay. So, I don't want to belabor it too much. We'll have to model again as a bunch of frequency and distance and our antenna heights and it's based on the Akamura model. Again, trying to make them fall into nice little equations. Okay. And so those equations are, again, slightly more complex and depending on the conditions in which you're operating. So, again, the main thing to take away from is, again, that the Hahn model tries to simplify the use of the Akamura model, okay? And people have continued along in that vein, developing models and trying to generalize them as much as possible. Again, the problem with all these models is that they tend to be somewhat dependent on the initial set of data that was used, so it may or may not correspond to, it may or may not have that much resemblance to wherever you're trying to model now. So what are we to take away from all of this? And what are we going to use moving forward? Well, going forward, we're just going to say that our loss is characterized as some factor of some exponent of the distance. Okay. So power drops as b to the gamma, and this value of gamma ranges from our free space loss value up to typically around 5.5. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, but moving forward, we're going to tend to just pick something. Okay. This decrease in power with respect to distance is the underpinning of how cellular systems operate. Okay, so it's why A, you need cells, so you need multiple base stations because you don't have infinite range, but also because you don't have infinite range, you aren't going to get infinite interference between one base station and another. And so that's the property that we use to design a cellular system. Okay. Now, that covers large-scale fading, and after today, that's, again, pretty much where we're going to stick. But it's worth being aware that that's not the entire picture. We also have what's called small-scale fading, and so this is a function of mobility and multipath as well, and the upshot of it is that, again, we think of power, right, so far we thought power is decreasing smoothly with distance, but it's actually going to fluctuate a lot with very small changes in distance, okay? And so that's going to present us with problems. So that's our last topic, so we'll take a break now, and then when we get back, we'll go through these small-scale fading effects. So, 15 minutes-ish. We'll see you back here.